This is Ian Pickus, and we're back in the Congressional Corner today with Democrat Pat Ryan from New York's 18th District. He's been in office since 2022. Congressman Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
So we're speaking just after President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress. There were some theatrics, of course. What was your takeaway from the speech?
I think that's the right word. There was a lot of performance and theatrics. What I was focused on and the lens through which I was watching the speech was, is the president going to speak to the number one issue I hear every single day from my constituents, which is affordability and the cost of housing, healthcare, prescription drugs, food and groceries, gas and utilities? He literally did not mention any of those things once in what was the longest speech, State of the Union, or joint address in the history of our country. And to me, that's just a failure of answering the needs of the people that that you're responsible to serve. So that's my number one priority, is around affordability, and was disappointed to hear that there was just nothing meaningful there. And in fact, most of the things proposed on the economic front, particularly tariffs, which are just a tax on working class and middle class people, we've seen already the financial impacts of that on the stock market, and unfortunately, I fear that my constituents in the Hudson Valley are going to feel that very sharply if those do go into place or remain in place. You put them in place yesterday.
We'll talk a lot more about some of the policy stuff, but I want to pause and just ask a question about tactics, because it's getting a lot of coverage and debate. You are obviously a Democrat who has thought about the lessons of the last election and how to earn back, you know, voter trust and so on. And, you know, some of your colleagues decided to skip the address. Some people were holding signs. One of them sort of interrupted and was tossed out. And it seems like all of those responses have gotten sort of predictable criticism from Republicans that they are disrespecting the presidency and so on. So in your mind, how should Democrats be facing this moment? What does a resistance that works look like to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, the in-the-moment theatrics and performance stuff is just a distraction. Trump is a master of division and distraction, but we can't let that take our eyes off or avert our gaze from how incredibly strained and stressed economically people are with the cost of everything, in particular housing in the Hudson Valley. So to me, the answer has to be listen to the people, truly listen to everybody, regardless of whether they voted for you or voted at all, and then deliver on what their pain points are. And anything else is just why people lose trust and faith in government at all levels, in particular why Congress's approval is so low. Rather than focusing on the things people need, you saw, and consistently across many years, unfortunately, in most of my adult lifetime, a bunch of career politicians bickering with each other rather than actually getting stuff done, solving problems. And there's a lot of disrespect shown, I think, all around by a lot of people last night, and that doesn't serve my constituents, which is the only thing I care about.
Did you hear anything in the address that you thought was a good idea?
Yeah, there were a few good ideas buried in there. I mean, I think some of the most compelling points, frankly, were when the president highlighted just incredible American heroes. You know, whether that's, you know, especially to me personally, to see that young man learn on live TV that he's getting accepted to West Point, which, you know, we'll be excited to have him in the district next year.
You, of course, are a graduate of West Point, I should just say.
Yes, and get the honor to represent it now, which is one of my best parts of this job. Seeing that 13-year-old young man, I mean, hearing from the steel worker and that's when I think the president was at his best, when he was not talking about himself or dividing us, but highlighting the best of the American people. On the policy front, there are a few ideas that I like. In particular, the president doubled down on his commitment from the campaign to remove taxes on Social Security, which I think would be a hugely positive thing for many of my constituents, given the affordability pressure everybody's facing. What's disappointing, of course, and frankly deceiving by him, I believe, is that is not included in the budget that the Republicans just squeaked through last week. So very disingenuous to me to make that promise again, knowing full well that is not in writing anywhere in the budget plan.
Do you fear that Social Security is now in line for cuts like many of your colleagues do?
Well, this is beyond a hypothetical or theoretical fear. In my district and in our community, Social Security is already under direct attack. And by that, I mean, just in the last few months, we have had two of the three Social Security offices closed in our district, in particular, due to the Trump administration's total chaos and the actions of Elon Musk, and who's completely unelected and unaccountable. We had our Social Security office in Poughkeepsie closed. Initially, it was claimed to be temporarily, but now it has appeared on the DOGE website, the official DOGE.gov website, under the quote-unquote savings category, meaning they're going to close it and cut it, and we can't get any answers. We've had multiple community rallies, including one yesterday that I wasn't able to make because I was in D.C., but folks are rightly outraged that the benefits, the Social Security benefits they paid into and earned their whole career, they literally can't access themselves, while Elon Musk has unfettered access to their private data. That, to me, is just fundamentally un-American. And I think some of the president's other misleading, to put it lightly, comments about the Social Security situation, to me, is him starting to sow disinformation and cloud the facts so that they can actually go after the program, which we know, and they've put in writing in Project 2025, they want to privatize and raise the age.
So, you know, your colleague to the south, George Latimer, the former Westchester County executive and the current county executive, they tried to, I think, call the Social Security Administration's bluff to a degree and offered county space to relocate one of the shuttered offices in the lower Hudson Valley. You know, if someone's listening to our conversation right now and they need access to a Social Security office in your district that is not available to them, what should they do?
Yeah, and it's outrageous that anyone should have to have that worry, but we've been communicating this throughout. So in the mean, there is one Social Security office left open in my entire three-county district to serve 800,000 people. That's in Middletown. And by the way, that one was moved from Newburgh with no notice and no warning. And so right now, because of the White Plains closure that you mentioned, the only Social Security office between New York City and Albany, there's only two. One is in Hudson and one is in Middletown. I mean, that's millions of people. So to answer your question, though, and help give people a little bit of reason for you know, not panicking, our office, my congressional office, is taking calls for those that are dealing, you know, need help with Social Security. The county offices for the aging in Ulster, Dutchess, and Orange are partnering with us. We're going to do a series of mobile, we call it our CARES van. It's our sort of mobile office coming up. We're going to announce that in the next few days, specifically focused on both Social Security and healthcare and Medicaid in general. So that's coming as a way to help plug the gap. But we need, you know, this is unsustainable to have no Social Security office for our folks. I actually introduced a bill called the Protecting Social Security Act last Congress and just reintroduced it. It both makes sure that the solvency of the program is held solid, and that if we need more funding, it's the ultra wealthy that pay, not middle class and working class people. And it also requires every county in the country to have at least one Social Security office, which to me feels like the bare minimum we should do, provide for folks that have paid into this program their whole lives.
Congressman Ryan, we were talking about the new tariff policy that President Trump has put in place on our two closest neighbors, Mexico and Canada. You mentioned that you have concerns about the impacts on the 18th district. So specifically, what are they?
And thanks for having me on, Ian. You know, I think we should replace the word tariff with what this actually is, which is a different T word, which is tax. This is a tax on working class and middle class people. And that's a well-proven economic fact throughout the history of time that the costs of these tariffs get passed on, not to the corporations that are continue to make record-breaking profits in our country, but to individuals in our community. So how is this going to manifest if these tariffs continue? Here's a few specific things that'll unfortunately, you know, affect folks' lives when they're already so tight economically. All consumer goods that we buy, from automobiles to things that, you know, clothing and other merchandise, immediately, there's a 25% tax on all those goods. And some, whether it's the full 25% or 18, 19, 20%, whatever it ends up being passed on by the retailers, that is paid for by us, which is outrageous. They're also taxing core goods needed to build housing, in particular lumber coming from Canada, which is where most of the lumber for all of our housing is coming from. We know housing affordability is the number one issue in our community, and we need to build more housing to lower costs and add supply, and this will make that much, much worse. We're going to drive up housing costs, retail good costs. It'll also affect food prices, and we know food prices are already outrageous. In particular, you know, the cost of eggs, we know, is catastrophic right now for individual families, as well as small businesses, restaurants, diners, and others that I've been talking to since, you know, over the last weeks and months. Those are just a few specific examples. You could go on across our entire economy and see how these kind of actions are going to ultimately be paid for by us, and that's just unacceptable.
So let me jump back to the House budget framework that was passed the other day. Obviously, you voted against it. It was a party line vote. And now we're looking at...
It actually wasn't. There was bipartisan opposition. There was one courageous Republican who voted against this budget. And that's important. I mean, I think that's an important fact.
Thank you for the correction. Right. It was 217 to 215, if my numbers are right. So how come you voted against it? I mean, what specifically are you concerned about within the framework?
There's a lot of in the weeds specifics I'm happy to go through, but at the high level, there are two major concerns I had, both of which go against fundamental promises that the president made in his campaign, by the way. Number one, and I think most strikingly, the budget adds $4 trillion to our national deficit when we know that's already a huge problem of our national deficit. Why does it add to the deficit? Because the tax bill extends record-breaking tax cuts to basically the wealthiest 1 to maybe 2% of people in the country who, no knock on them, but I don't think they need more help right now. It's middle class and working class people that need help. So it extends massive, unprecedented tax breaks for big corporations and the ultra wealthy. And to try to somewhat close that gap, they're making huge, huge cuts to critical health care programs, in particular Medicaid, which in my district of 800,000 people, about 25% of my constituents rely on Medicaid for their health care, including over 100,000 kids under the age of 18 through the CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. And that would just be devastating to folks, both in terms of their health, but also the cost aspect when health care is already too expensive. So there are a lot of other specifics I had, you know, problems with in the budget, but those were the high level. Adds to the deficit, gives more tax breaks to the ultra wealthy, and it's paid for on the backs of middle class and working class people and their health care.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the role of Elon Musk in this administration, and there have been, I would say it's fair to characterize it this way, sort of random cuts at different federal agencies. And it's been confusing for people who are being, you know, handed a cardboard box after a 30-year career. So to the extent that you know, what are the impacts of the federal layoffs within your district?
Well, I think, you know, there's wide agreement that government at every level needs to always be looking at being more efficient. When I was a county executive, I was very focused on that and found a lot of savings in our county budget and actually lowered taxes to the lowest level in 40 years. So that, you know, that's a bipartisan place of agreement. That needs to be done, though, with a scalpel, not a sledgehammer. And what we're seeing instead is...
Well, in this case, sorry to interrupt, but it was a literal chainsaw.
You're right. I shouldn't laugh about that, but you're right. As seeing a foreign authoritarian dictator give a chainsaw to Elon Musk was quite a 2025 moment for all of us. But chainsaw or sledgehammer, whatever analogy or reality you want to use, there have been real human consequences, not only in folks that are losing their job. And just for example, over 10,000 now veterans, which are a huge part of the federal workforce, over 30% of the federal workforce are veterans, have been fired with no cause, no good reason. And what's important, I think, for people to understand about these broad-based cuts are these aren't based on performance or failure to meet goals. These are totally arbitrary, largely focused on kind of how long you've been in an agency, particularly if you're what they call a probationary employee, meaning newly hired within the last year. So imagine you've been working to recruit and hire new, young, talented people to your agency for a year or two. You just got them in. They're just getting trained. They're at their 9-month mark and with no notice and really cruel rhetoric around it as well. These folks are just terminated. And that's had a ripple effect in our district. It's had ripple effects across the country. And again, what's really infuriating to me is it hurts all of us. I mean, it hurts people that count on these services. So an example of the impact of this is at our own VA, the Castle Point VA Medical Center in Wappingers, which is where I also go for my own care as a veteran. We've had 20 inpatient beds that are set up to deal with veterans dealing with mental health crisis and/or overdoses and addiction, which we know is a huge problem, especially for veterans, but for all of us. Those beds were closed with no notice, more due to the hiring freeze put in place by Trump than actually to layoffs. But it's the same really harmful effect. So we've now had our Social Security office closed with no transparency and no notice. A huge part of our VA closed. We've had farmers across our district have loans that they had already signed paperwork with the USDA to improve their farms canceled or frozen. We've had Head Start funding for youth child care frozen and lots of other things. And I really believe that this is not what the American people voted for here. And we need to, without judgment or partisanship, just explain these impacts and these harms. And help people understand that, there's a better choice. And that's, going back to our earlier segment, where we as Democrats have to not just be in opposition to the harm, but also offer a better path forward. And that's something I'm very focused on.
Now, you raised VA healthcare, but you're also looking into private healthcare, and you have some questions and concerns about the status of care within the Hudson Valley at facilities that have been overtaken by Optum. Can you explain what your query is?
Yeah, this could be its own segment itself, I believe, but to be very brief about it, we've seen the consolidation of almost all of our local healthcare economy in the Hudson Valley by one mega corporation called Optum, which is actually owned by United Healthcare. And in buying up all these local practices, whether that was CareMount in Ulster and Dutchess County or Crystal Run Healthcare in Orange County and a lot of other local practices, they have totally taken control and have vertically integrated and created a monopoly on healthcare. What that has resulted in is much less quality of care, higher costs, longer wait times, unsatisfied and understaffed healthcare workers and doctors. And the only people winning are the bosses and the sort of the suits at United Healthcare that are making record shattering profits quarter after quarter now as they consolidate their grip on this monopoly. So we just put out a survey of our constituents last week asking basically, what has your experience been if you're getting care at Optum? We've had over 2,000 responses that are just heartbreaking, infuriating, ridiculous. And the amount of harm and suffering, both economically and just in terms of quality of care that people are experiencing under this consolidation is totally unacceptable. So we're working on both immediate action there, but also long-term legislation and legal action to to hold this monopoly more accountable by UnitedHealthcare.
Just for our listeners to know, we did reach out to Optum's parent company for comment and have not heard back, and we will update listeners if we do. So here's a question for you. The New York Rangers are pretty garbage this year. Why are you so keen to watch them?
Yeah, all our New York teams have been tough. Although, you know, I'm still, Knicks are you know, showing some good promise. We're excited about that. On a serious note, I think you're referring to this battle we've had with Optimum, which is the latest name change of the corporate overlord that owns your TV coverage and so on. There's been this ongoing corporate battle between MSG, which owns all the rights to the sports teams, especially Knicks and Rangers, and then Optimum, which is a cable provider. And the collateral damage in this corporate back and forth on negotiating prices was that there were blackouts of a bunch of sports games for fans that were already paying for this and just wanting to watch their local team, hoping the Rangers would win. The good news is the dispute was finally resolved. The bad news is a bunch of my constituents and others that paid didn't get to watch these games. So myself and the Attorney General, Tish James, just press them to these companies to give refunds to our constituents that have been harmed by this. And we're going to keep pushing on this fight. But this is part of a larger push I've made on nationally sports blackouts that are happening, that are hurting fans across the country, because we've allowed, again, really the consolidation of monopolistic power by a few big companies. And the people who get hurt are fans just trying to watch games that are already paying.
You know, we've been asking everybody about their votes on the Laken Riley Act, which the majority in the House put forward as one of the first bills of the new term. You voted no on that. How come?
Well, it was one of the harder votes, certainly. To me, the problem with the bill was, I mean, I've been very clear and strong on the need to increase our border security and reform our immigration system. That's not really what the bill primarily did. The big problem with the bill that I had is that it extended beyond, I think, a foundational constitutional principle of due process and allowed those that even are accused of a crime to be punished. And to me, there needs to be, as defined in our Constitution, due process before a punishment is invoked for anybody. And so that was my main opposition on that legislation.
What are you hearing about ICE showing up on the streets of Kingston? There have been some reports about that so far, and given what the administration has said about its, you know, hardline roundup policy and comments from people like Tom Homan, what are you hearing?
Well, there's two pieces. One, we're getting very little information from federal authorities, which is a problem. I've been in close touch with our local law enforcement, in this case, the Ulster County Sheriff. But unfortunately, these agencies have largely carte blanche to do this and don't actually have to coordinate with locals, which is a problem in and of itself. The other piece here is, while I think we can all agree, known violent criminals should not be and have no place in our community or our country, the idea of mass deportations that Trump campaigned on will be very harmful to the country, not only morally, but certainly economically, when you think about all the businesses, farms, and others that count on those who are here just trying to work and provide a living for their family and contribute to the country. So another example of we need to be more precise and not demonize huge groups of people.
What was your reaction to the Oval Office meeting between Vice President Vance, President Trump, and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky?
I mean, at a high level, it shows you the danger of what a narcissist can do in terms of sowing global instability, and how this is a huge worry of mine that that President Trump, who really I don't think understands the stakes and the fact that we have men and women deployed around the world who might be hurt and our own people hurt by these actions, lets his own ego and pride have an open, public, disrespectful back and forth like that that doesn't make our country any safer whatsoever.
And given the comments about you know, Ukraine being led by a dictator and sort of starting the war, which are just not true, what do you make of American foreign policy right now vis-a-vis the Ukraine war?
Well, I think there's broad agreement that 3+ years in, an end to the war is what everybody and more than any what everybody wants, in particular the Ukrainian soldiers who I've met with in my own office who want an end to this war. That doesn't mean that we allow a dictator who, as you said, himself invaded a foreign country, a near unprecedented thing since you know World War II, almost 100 years ago, that we let him get away with that, or even in the case of President Trump, that we parrot his lies and talking points and enable dictators now from Putin to Kim Jong-un, who sent North Korean troops, as we know, actively engaged in combat. Of course, China heavily involved here, and Iran. And, you know, to me, I think, again, the American people did not vote to be in the same camp as this axis of dictators around the world. We are a country that stands for freedom for all. Those are the values I, you know, proudly fought for 27 months in combat. And I still think the broad set of the American people agree on that. And so another place where very concerned about Trump's both rhetoric and actions.
Now, you're in the House, not the Senate, so you didn't get to vote on him, but you did come out in opposition to the choice of Pete Hegseth to be the defense secretary. Wondering what you make of the performance he's had now that he's been in the job for a few weeks.
Unfortunately, it's pathetic, his performance. He's totally unqualified, separate from his personal, well-documented issues of integrity and character, which I think should have been disqualifying on their own, but his total lack of experience. He fell flat on his face in Europe and almost blew up, you know, our relationship with the continent single-handedly, although Trump and Vance seem to have furthered that, as you said last week. And again, the folks who are hurt here, while he's primarily focused on culture war stuff, Hegseth, it's our own troops, our own readiness that pay the price. This is something I'm very focused on in the Armed Services Committee. When he comes before our committee, I will certainly have lots of strong concerns and questions for him, as I imagine many others will.
Let me wrap up with a political question for you. What did you think of your predecessor, Antonio Delgado's decision not to run for another term with Governor Hochul as lieutenant governor?
Wasn't expecting it.
Well, you know him well. Do you think he's serious about running for governor next year?
I honestly have no idea, and I'll let him speak for himself on that one.
Okay, that's New York Congressman Pat Ryan, a Democrat from the 18th District in office since 2022. And we're happy to say a stalwart guest here on the Congressional Corner. Congressman Ryan, thanks for all the time, and we look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Ian.